The epidemiologist with whom I spoke said it was the largest outbreak that he's worked with in his time in Alaska.
Bad seal oil causes a botulism outbreak in the Bristol Bay region. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal office tasked with assisting a gas pipeline for Alaska prepares to close.
The House and Senate, when they passed the 2015 budget, did not include any funding in there for the gas line office. The law wasn't changed, so the combination is we close down.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to health care. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
Health officials are warning of a botulism outbreak from a batch of seal oil produced recently in the Bristol Bay village of Twin Hills near Togiak. A state investigation into the outbreak says more than 25 people may have consumed the seal oil, and they're working quickly to track them down. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The first reported botulism infections came last Friday from the village of Quinnahock. Two cases were so severe that the patients were medevaced to Anchorage and remain on respiratory support as they're unable to breathe on their own. Officials with the State Department of Epidemiology were able to track the botulism to a batch of seal oil made in Twin Hills, and as Dr. Kathy Heinemann from Kanakanak Hospital says, sent that oil in for further testing.
The oil that was from the master batch or the place that it was produced was definitely positive for the botulinum toxin. And I even got a note this morning saying that it was the highest level the lab instrument can measure.
State health officials and local medical providers have been working together to track down anybody who may have bought or eaten any of that seal oil. The latest tally is over 25, including 5 from Quinnahock, several from Twin Hills, and several more in Dillingham. One child has so far tested positive for symptoms, and several others being monitored have so far been asymptomatic. The concern, says Heinemann, is that the number of cases in this botulism outbreak may continue to grow.
Indeed, I believe that there may be people that we don't know about.
In an odd twist, the state's infectious disease program says that the Twin Hills family who produced the seal oil initially refused to stop consuming it after the test results showed it was toxic. Botulism is a disease caused by bacteria, which produces a toxin, almost always in fermented foods like canned fish and stink heads. Seal oil appears to be the main culprit of botulism in Alaska, but this outbreak seems particularly potent and widespread.
The epidemiologist with whom I spoke said it was the largest outbreak that he's worked with in his time in Alaska.
Health officials take botulism outbreaks very seriously, in large part because the disease can lead to death.
It could be lethal, and the problem is that botulism toxin does not smell or taste like anything. The food can look and seem to be perfectly normal, but yet be contaminated.
The onset of symptoms can begin as early as one day after consumption to as many as 10 days after. Dr. Heinemann recommends anyone who suspects they may have eaten that seal oil to plan to be near a medical provider during that period of time. The state sent a public health nurse from Anchorage out to Dillingham to continue the investigation today. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The company trying to reopen the controversial Tulsacoa Chief mine in British Columbia announced a setback yesterday. It says a big investor is pulling out of the project. Chieftain Metals Company says it will use a bridge loan to repay a $10 million advance from Denver-based Royal Gold. Chieftain had been counting on another $45 million from Royal Gold to develop the mine, according to a July agreement that Royal Gold has now scrapped. The Tulsacoa Chief is one of 5 proposed mining projects near the Taku River that has Southeast Alaskans and fishermen worried. The enormous KSM project this week won environmental approval from the Canadian government. Chieftain Metals is proposing to move supplies into the Tulsacoa and transport minerals out by barging them on the Taku. Governor Bill Walker yesterday announced an agreement that may help bring North Slope natural gas to Japan, but the Trans Alaska gas pipeline project has met some resistance in Washington, D.C. For one, the federal coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline is closing up shop. Also, opponents of gas exports are raising their voice, and their targets include the pipeline Walker and many Alaskans pin their economic hopes on. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Larry Persily, the federal coordinator for the Alaska Gas Line, figures they'll close the doors on their offices in Washington and Anchorage at the end of February. Until then, Persily says, they'll be organizing files and archiving material.
We have some leftover funds from previous appropriations we have not spent, and we will be using those savings for an orderly shutdown.
Persily says the 2004 law creating the Federal Coordinator's Office was intended to expedite permitting for a different pipeline, one that would take North Slope gas through Canada and into the Midwest.
Back in 2004, the idea was that if you don't get Alaska North Slope gas into the North American grid, if you don't get Alaska gas to the lower 48, lower 48 could go cold, you could run out of gas for generating plants for electricity.
Then came the fracking boom, and suddenly the lower 48 has more gas than anyone could have imagined. So proponents of the Alaska project revised the plan. Now the state of Alaska and the producers intend to build an 800-mile pipeline to Nikiski and export LNG by ship. Officially, though, the Office of the Federal Coordinator is still supposed to be working on a pipeline to the lower 48. And Persily says only Congress can change that.
The House and Senate, when they passed the 2015 budget, did not include any funding in there for the gas line office. The law wasn't changed, so the combination is we closed down.
A spokesman for Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's committed to ensuring someone is responsible for coordination. Robert Dillon says Murkowski tried last year to update the authorizing law for the coordinator's office, but then learned the producers don't find the office necessary. He says the senator wasn't able to get the appropriation this year. Dillon points out the budget request President Obama sent to Congress had no money for the office either. Under Persily, a former journalist, the coordinator's office has primarily been an information agency. His staff has produced white papers and maintained a website with news about permitting the LNG market and competing efforts. Persily acknowledges the loss of his office doesn't derail the pipeline.
Certainly other pipelines, refineries have been built, oil and gas production facilities. There are a couple of LNG export projects under construction. They were all done without such a coordinating office, but they were much smaller projects than this.
The main barrier for the gas line is that no one has committed enough capital. Altogether, it's expected to cost as much as $65 billion. Meanwhile, though, the Alaska project is being swept up in the national opposition to LNG exports. More than 100 advocacy groups sent a letter this week to Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, urging him to withhold support from bills that would expedite federal permits for gas exports around the country. Groups ranging from the Sierra Club and United Methodist Women to the National Nurses Union signed the letter, saying responsible climate and energy policy is to keep natural gas underground and refuse to export it to other countries. One of the groups that signed the letter was the Center for Biological Diversity. Its Alaska director, Rebecca Noblin, says that though the letter mentions gas from fracking, their opposition extends to North Slope LNG exports, too.
The Alaska project, like any other LNG export project, just poses too great a risk to the climate to go through a fast-track permitting process. When you look at the state of the climate right now, we really should be putting the brakes on fossil fuel development, not greasing the wheels.
Natural gas has a mixed reputation in environmental circles. On the one hand, when burned to create electricity, it emits far less carbon dioxide than coal. But when natural gas leaks into the atmosphere unburned, scientists say it becomes an especially powerful greenhouse gas. Opponents say liquefying the fuel also adds to the impact. The industry says it's drastically reduced natural gas leaks from its operations. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Fort Yukon residents help each other through a power shortage.
Everybody checked on their neighbors, and everybody pulled together. It was just really very touching.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The lights are back on in Fort Yukon, including the Christmas trees, now that three of the village's four electrical generators are functioning again. A couple of weeks ago, the holidays didn't look so happy for the remote Yukon River community when all but one of its generators broke down. But the community got through by cutting back and helping each other out. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Franny Hughes is CEO of the Gwichaja Utility Company in Fort Yukon, known by the locals as GZ Utility. And Hughes says last week she was happy to tell her customers something that may sound unusual this time of year.
Plug in your Christmas trees.
Hughes says she put the word out last week to light up the holiday decorations after several days of blackouts and brownouts and then voluntary electricity cutbacks by Fort Yukon's 600 residents. This after two of GZ Utility's four generators broke down earlier this month, including unit number four, which she says had just been rebuilt and reconnected to the village's microgrid.
Generator actually exploded is why we were without any kind of real backup.
So she says while GZ struggled to get a Fairbanks-based heavy equipment shop to repair the big generator and get it back online, the utility limped along using a smaller generator, and during daytime peak load, they fired up generator number one, the big old unit that doesn't run well and burns lots of diesel fuel. But mainly they relied on one of the two smaller and more efficient generators, number three. It ran so reliably that she named it after the plucky little locomotive in the children's storybook.
Generator number three, that's the little engine that could, that kept us going.
But generators one and three couldn't provide enough power reliably for all of the utility's 255 households and its biggest customers, including the K-12 schoolhouse, the Yukon Flats Health Center, the Fort Yukon Airport, and the university's Alaska Satellite Facility.
This big satellite dish, they actually keep that dish warm and heated, and that takes a lot of kilowatts.
Luckily, all those facilities had their own backup generators, which they all used while GZ Utility scrambled to get its generators fixed. But the community's water and wastewater treatment facility did not have a backup unit, and Hughes says it was critical to keep it functioning. So she got the message out to everyone to reduce their use of electricity as much as possible.
We told all the residents to cut back, minimal use only. We didn't even want your porch light on.
Hughes says just about everyone not only cut back on electricity, but also water use to reduce the water and sewage treatment plant's electrical load. No showers, minimal flushing of toilets. David Bridges runs the Fort Yukon Airport Terminal, and he says it really wasn't all that difficult.
Yes, I mean, some people had Christmas lights on, so they turned them off. I mean, but besides that, there wasn't really anything extremely out of the ordinary that you did.
Bridges says part of the reason the community got through it all so well was because of a little help from Mother Nature.
We were lucky that it wasn't extremely cold, so your vehicles didn't have to be plugged in because they do draw a lot of juice.
Hughes says she believes the ordeal shows the strength of the community.
I think everybody pulled through okay. Everybody checked on their neighbors, and everybody pulled together. It was just really very touching.
Hughes isn't sure whether there was any sort of serendipity at work to test the utility's backup plans and the community's cohesion to get through tough times. But she can't help but notice that the diesel-fueled electrical generating system nearly failed just when the utility was finalizing a plan to build a $4.3 million power plant that uses wood as fuel, harvested from the surrounding forest, instead of some 250,000 gallons of diesel at a cost this year of $6 a gallon, which must be brought by barge up the Yukon River every summer.
And it's so weird that we have all of these plans and we've been putting them into action, and for this to happen, it's like a fluke.
GZ utility officials estimate the new biomass-fueled combined heat and power plant will save the community nearly $500,000 annually by reducing the amount of diesel used to generate electricity by about half. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Winter usually has a different feel in Unalaska compared to the rest of the state. The days aren't as short, and the temperatures are nowhere near as cold. But as Alaska faces yet another year of below-average snowfall, the Aleutians are beginning to look a lot less exceptional. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
On Monday morning, a rare sound rang out across the parking lot at Unalaska's community center. That's a snowplow scraping up the fluffy stuff that had accumulated overnight. Driver Steve Ingman says he can't remember the last time Unalaska's roads crew had to clean out that lot.
So far this year we've had ice to deal with, no snow, freezing rain and like that.
Despite the occasional ice, it's actually been warmer than usual in the Aleutians this year, according to Christian Cassell. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service.
The one big driver of temperatures are the sea surface temperatures, and they have been near all-time record highs over much of the Bering and the North Pacific right now.
Almost 10 degrees above normal in some areas. That's more than enough to throw storms off their track. With no influx of cold Arctic air, Cassell says the Aleutians have stayed pretty balmy, and it isn't just limited to this winter. For the last year and a half, storms have been moving off kilter.
And that's resulting in snowfall deficits over your area and pretty much most of Alaska.
There's a normal cycle of warming and cooling that takes place in the Pacific Ocean, but Cassell says it looks like another pattern is at play, an El Niño. That's the official name for a warm weather anomaly that starts out in the Pacific Ocean. The signs are all there, but Cassell says the water needs to stay warm just a little longer. Until then, all forecasters are willing to say is this.
We're kind of going into an El Nino-ish type pattern.
So where does that leave the Aleutians? Is there any hope for a white Christmas, or will it just be white-ish?
There is a big low kind of moving well southeast of Unalaska up towards the Gulf of Alaska, and that'll bring some northerly flow that usually brings some Arctic air and some snowfall, but it seems like it's so warm right now that I'm not too sure that it's going to be snow. It may just be cold rain.
But Steve Ingman isn't sweating it just yet. The snowplow driver says winter in the Aleutians can vary.
It's been a slow year, but last couple of years it hasn't started until after Christmas, around Christmas time. So January, we're hopeful for January and February to be some heavy snow days.
Not because of the plowing, though.
So get the snow machines out and play around, snowboard a little bit, yeah.
Now that's the spirit. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Haines doesn't have a shelter or official service for people who are homeless. So what happens when a homeless couple shows up in Haines determined to find a place to stay? That happened to a couple who slept in shelters and on the streets for 3 years before finding a home in Haines. KHNS's Emily Files has the story.
When I asked Roger and Judy Clay how they met, they both laughed at the memory.
When I was down in Washington State, I figured I'd try my hand at working at a little convenience store called 7-Eleven. And a certain party happened to be my 4 a.m. customer.
Judy and Roger married in 1998, and soon after they moved to Anchorage. Roger says he never expected to end up homeless, but he lost his job, and a few years later, he says money he received from a trust fund ran out.
A lot of people think that homeless people are all alcoholics. And they're not. A lot of them became homeless the same way I did, loss of income.
Roger and Judy were evicted from their home in May 2011. Each night, they would line up at the Brother Francis shelter and hope they could get one of a few dozen beds in men's and women's dorms. If they didn't, they had to sleep on mats on the floor in communal rooms with more than 100 other people. But that was better than sleeping outside. Brother Francis has a 30 days in, 30 days out policy, though Roger says they made exceptions when the temperature dropped below freezing.
We found a place to sleep outside.
Yeah, it was just up the hillside from the shelter. We made an agreement with the manager that is, as long as we were gone before him and his customers showed up, we could stay there.
Judy says it felt like it took months to thaw out from the cold of sleeping outside. When she had an opportunity, she decided to get back to her hometown of Haines.
When my PFD check come in that one year, I had already, without even telling Roger, I'd already made the decision that we were going to come back to Haines, one way or another.
When they came to Haines, someone in the community called Sierra Jimenez at Southeast Alaska Independent Living, or SAIL. They said Roger and Judy could use her help.
They were very quiet. They seemed desperate. They did not have a plan.
Jimenez says SAIL paid for them to stay in a hotel that night, and the next day, Salvation Army paid for their one-way trip to Juneau. It was the best they could do, since there's no shelter in Haines. The Clays stayed at the Glory Hole shelter in Juneau for another year and a half. While they were there, Roger successfully applied for supplemental security income because of his disability.
I have a major depression with psychotic tendencies and psoriatic arthritis.
Roger and Judy took the ferry back to Haines in the spring of 2014. Now that they had some income, Jimenez was able to help them. She called a friend who had an apartment open and convinced them to rent to the Clays. Then Jimenez helped Roger and Judy apply for an apartment in the only affordable housing complex in Haines, Dusty Trails. Those apartments are subsidized by the federal government. Rent is based on 30% of the resident's income. The Clays had to apply two times, but they were finally successful.
It was a lot of pieces to pull together. Yeah. But you guys persevered.
The Clays moved into their new apartment November 1st. It's a sparsely decorated two-bedroom. In the living room, there's a TV and two hand-me-down couches. Roger sits on one of them and says things feel peaceful here.
The quiet seems different than when we were homeless. Because when we were homeless, it was practically noisy 24/7.
After the stress of homelessness, the Clays feel like they can relax. The Clays aren't the only homeless people SAIL has helped. Jimenez says they help on average 5 to 10 people each year.
There are people in all different levels of homelessness, more than people know in this community or like to believe.
The patchwork of local charities and nonprofits that help homeless people here do the best they can, but that often means sending people to Juneau.
And I guess that's really the question I want the community to ask ourselves is this how we want to deal with homelessness? And I think that it's really easy to ship people out, but is that who we are and what we want to do?
She says Roger and Judy's story is a great success, but unfortunately, it's not the norm. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska natives have tanned fish skins for centuries to make bags, shoes, and other useful items. Now fish skin leather is appearing on high-end products from Prada, Nike, and Dior. Commercially produced salmon leather is made in mass in Europe and Chile. But in Alaska, it's still made by hand, one fish at a time. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned more.
Artist Joel Isaac slides his thumb along the body of a mostly frozen salmon, prying the fish skin off of the flesh. He grasps the loosening skin tightly with his other hand to create tension.
Every fish is going to be different, too, for how much it wants to let go of its skin and how much it wants to stay.
Isaac is teaching a workshop on fish skin sewing at the Anchorage Museum. The young Athabascan artist has skinned thousands of fish. He started when he was 5 to help his family prepare salmon for canning. Now he harvests the skin for making clothing and art. When the skin is off the fish, he scrapes off the remaining fat and flesh with a spoon, trying carefully not to rip the thin membrane. Tiny fish bones still protrude from one area.
That's the sound of scraping on the bones.
Isaac says he began working with fish skin 4 years ago after seeing a fish skin basket made by the late Fran Reed.
And so I went inside and I was like, I love this. This is so cool. And I want to learn how to do it. And so I started Googling. And there's not a lot of information on the internet. And it's a few sentences here and there.
So he started experimenting with different ways to degrease the fish using Dawn soap, baking soda, and other chemicals. Before studying art, he studied chemistry. And his scientific methods and curiosity have stuck with him. Next, he tried tanning the skins with teas or oiling them with different fats and brain matter. He says salmon skin isn't waterproof unless it's treated with oils. Eventually, Isaac met elders who had worked with fish skins and could teach him some of the historical methods.
And so it was just nice to have someone who'd seen their grandparents do it and who'd done it before watch what I was doing and make sure that I was doing it correctly.
Isaac says once he learned the traditional ways of making bags and shoes, he started pushing the boundaries and mixing old and new materials.
If you start doing hybrids of things, where is it really strong and where are some things that you need to go back to the historically correct method?
But for Isaac, fish skin is also a beautiful art object that connects him to his roots.
The material itself has its own will. It wants to expand and contract when it gets wet. If it's more humid, it'll be more flexible. If it's drier, it's more rigid. Like, it reacts to its environment, so it never completely loses that live quality.
In the classroom, Victoria Cronquist slowly tries to skin her frozen sockeye salmon.
Salmon are just kind of amazing fish.
She says she tried skinning salmon on her own, but she hasn't been very successful. Now she has more hope.
I have been eating salmon for a long time, and it's kind of sad to throw the skin away. So it's kind of neat to be able to use it, especially possibly to wear it.
After some effort, the fish releases its skin, and Kronko starts to think about what to make with it. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Tim Ellis in Delta, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Emily Files in Haines, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer. From all of us at Alaska Public Media, happy holidays, Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.